Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. It's literary festival time in New Orleans, so we thought we'd talk with Thomas Mallon. His most recent book is The Very Heart of It, New York Diaries, 1983 to 1994, and he will be a featured speaker at the Tennessee Williams in New Orleans Literary Festival and the Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival. It is such a pleasure to welcome Thomas Mallon to The Reading Life. He's the author of 11 novels, including Landfall, which spins a tale of the politics surrounding Hurricane Katrina, Henry and Clara, Fellow Travelers, and Up with the Sun. His nonfiction books include Mrs. Payne's Garage and, most recently, The Very Heart of It, New York Diaries, 1983 to 1994. He is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker, The New York Times Book Review, and other publications. He has been the literary editor of GQ and the deputy chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Tom lives in Washington, D.C. Thomas Mallon, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me.
Like so many people, I came to your work first through your nonfiction work, A Book of One's Own, People and Their Diaries, and it was such an inviting conspiratorial book, you know. Let us look at these books that writers kept for themselves. You know what I mean?
Right.
So what did you learn about writing by writing that book?
I was writing it as sort of a practitioner because I had already been keeping diaries for years. And I decided I would write about them because I was a great reader of them as well. And I, even though I was a college professor in those days, I taught at Vassar, I didn't want to write, you know, some kind of academic study of these books. That didn't seem to work for books as intimate as those. I wanted to write a kind of personal take on the books. You know, the diary, it grows out in some ways of the commonplace book as a genre. Mm-hmm. People used to keep what were in effect diaries of their reading. And I thought I would just, you know, be opinionated, informal, whatever. And to my great surprise, 42 years ago, the book took off. It did quite well. And it's come full circle now because these diaries of mine that you mentioned, my own diaries, The Very Heart of It, they're out now. And when the paperback of them comes out a few months from now, Knopf Vintage is going to reissue A Book of One's Own after all those decades. So they're going to, you know, offer them kind of as a set in a way. The covers even mimic each other.
Oh, nice. Well, it was very brave of you in some ways. It's almost as if you dared yourself to publish your own diaries.
You know, I did say when I wrote that book about diaries, I did say in A Book of One's Own, no one ever kept a diary just for himself. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that anybody who kept them had somebody in mind. It may not be anybody specific. It might just be imagining that somebody will discover them in an attic 100 years from now or whatever. But I think that the words always have to start going someplace for the writer to keep going. And I had no particular plans, really, to publish these books, but I got the idea of doing this book, The Very Heart of It, about 6 or 7 years ago, during the pandemic, or just before, I was starting to think about my papers. I have all of these manuscripts, proofs, literary correspondence, photographs. I mean, libraries that collect writers' papers tend to be completists. They want everything. And so all of that stuff eventually went to the Library of Congress here in Washington. And before that happened, there was a man who came to appraise the material, and I knew they were more interested in the diaries, 146 volumes of them, than in anything else. So they were lined up, you know, across a long dining room table here in the house. And he said to me, you know, I'd like to look at them, and I'd also like to see some transcript to give me a sense of what they're like. And I just kind of arbitrarily started reading and transcribing some material from the 1980s, which was a very tumultuous time for me. Mm-hmm. And Of course, it's pretty far in the past now. And I wouldn't even say I was rereading these diaries. I would have to say I was reading them because I hadn't ever read them. I'd written them, but I hadn't read them.
Yeah.
And so here I was 47 years later. And the first thing that struck me as I was reading about my first days in New York, actually living in Manhattan, was a kind of manic quality. I was very excited, very happy one day. I was making progress as a writer. I had gotten an assignment from some magazine or gotten a good review of something. And then I would crash to earth the next day because there would be horrible news about AIDS. And I was living in the shadow of that. I had had a love affair with somebody who died in 1984, which was fairly early days, desperate days, nothing they could do for anybody.
Right.
There wasn't even a test in those days. So, and the next day I would just, you know, shake it off, as Taylor Swift would say, and, you know, just get back out there. And then, you know, a day after that, I'd get news that a friend was sick or something like that. So it was an extremely up and down time for me. The sine curve of my life was very, very sharp, very, very pointy. So I thought that, you know, there was some interest here. And I went to my editor at The New Yorker and I said, you know, would you be interested in these? And the magazine published about a good chunk of them, 6,000-7,000 words, late in 2022. Mm-hmm. And then my book editor said, do you think there's a book here? So I said yes. And that became what's out now, the very heart of it.
Well, there's such a great New York book. There are so many people who love books about New York, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you capture it in such a particular time.
Yeah. You know, in many ways, the city was coming back. It had been really down on its luck in the 1970s. You know, it was bankrupt, mm-hmm. and that was the time of the famous Ford to City drop dead headline. And it was really kind of scary. Crime was enormously high in the 70s, whatever. The 80s, it was beginning to rebound. Koch was the mayor. He was very feisty. He was unafraid to fight with everybody. But at the same time as the 80s were sort of, you know, roaring along, there was this terrible, terrible harvesting of souls that was going on in the city. And when I read all of this, I was just sort of, I don't know, I was struck by a certain wonderment about myself. I sort of enough to say to myself, how did we all live through this? You know?
Yeah.
And I was a lucky person. I was healthy and remained healthy. And mm-hmm. But there were terrible things going on, and there was constant, terrible uncertainty. But I think the answer is that you went on living because there's simply no alternative to that. You simply can't stop. You simply can't concentrate on doom 24 hours a day, although I think we're in a period when
we're doing
a lot of that going on. And, but I think that that struck me. And I did think, I was never self-consciously writing history when I wrote the diaries, but I did think that some of the material was worth preserving, you know, worth publishing, because it had a certain historical value. And again, coming full circle, my favorite diarists in A Book of One's Own, the diarists I wrote about, my favorite ones were the ones I called the chroniclers. They're in the first chapter, and they're the people who keep these long diaries over decades, and their primary focus is not on analyzing their emotions, analyzing their own experience, figuring out what they feel, not emotional self-analysis. They look at other people. They look at what's going on in public life. They look at the other people who are at the party, not themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the effect of that, I discovered reading so many other people's diaries, was that in many instances, they wind up telling you more about themselves than do diaries that are frankly self-reflective, you know, and are all about analyzing one's own emotions. You know, they say in fiction, there are all these ways to create a character, and primarily it should be what the character does. Mm-hmm. But then there's what the character says about himself, and then there's what other people say about the character, and then there's also what the character says about other people. In other words, you get at a person in an oblique way. You know, don't tell me about yourself. Tell me what you're thinking about what's around you. So there was something of that in the book.
Did you see what she did to him? Did you hear what they said? Just a New York conversation rattling in my head.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Thomas Mallon. His new book is The Very Heart of It, New York Diaries, 1983 to 1994. Well, one of the things I love about those diaries is how smitten you are with the city. And it's this classic tale of just wanting to get there so badly and finally making it there. And you retain this profound sense of your own good luck, even in the face of such tragedy.
I think that's really true. I don't think I'm particularly gifted with a sense of proportion. but I think in some bedrock way, that is part of my personality. And if I step back at all, even 6 inches from where I am and look at myself, I realize my circumstances are really lucky, whatever I might be up against at any given moment. And of course, New York is the place where, you know, one still thinks about making it happen. Mm-hmm. The other thing I was struck by when I looked at the diaries, and in fact, I found this in the diaries, I wrote it at the time, I was aware of it. I was living my 20s and my 30s. When I got to New York, I was about to turn 32, and I was already on my way to tenure at Vassar. I had a contract for that book about diaries, whatever. I mean, by all standards, material standards, professional career standards, I was doing fine. And I realized, but now I was in New York. I had left Vassar, which was a very kind of self-contained little campus, and I would commute up to it by train. And I lived in this rickety little walk-up apartment in Manhattan. And I realized this is what I could have been doing at 22 instead of 32. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, I was doing it with a large cushion of insurance underneath me. I wasn't a starving writer in a garret. I had a really good job. Didn't have enough time to write as a college professor. But, you know, I did have a kind of head start. And I was determined to, in some ways, make up for the time I had lost, the time when I could have been in New York in my 20s.
Well, you do something that's really useful for young writers in these diaries. You own up to your own ambition because you really want to be a star and you're willing to do the work.
I work hard. There was a literary life, which I was sort of nibbling at the edges of in the 80s, was very social in those days.
I don't know. You could be like Andy Warhol's diaries for this. I mean, the index alone.
Oh, right. And I adopted the Barbara Streisand rule, though. I didn't put an index. I figured, I mean, most of the people I know and I write about and I'm involved with are not really famous people. But if I cite somebody, you know, and I did have these adventures with, prominent writers. Mm-hmm. I edited Gore Vidal a number of times at GQ, things like that. I would write about them. Those were the other people that I, as a chronicler, would write about. But, I've had friends come to me and say, God, you know, you went to so many parties. When did you ever work? And I have to tell them, you know, if you look at the dates, you'll see that sometimes there's, you know, 10 days between those two entries that you're reading. So, it was during those 10 days that I was at my desk all the time.
Well, it cracked me up because I'd be going along. There'd be Richard Ford. Okay, check. All right. Mm-hmm. Thomas Beller. Okay. All right. Ben Patron. Okay. I mean, just all these names that were familiar to me from publishing.
Right.
Because we are the same age. It was just really a pleasure to go through that.
And yeah. I really do try not to, today I try not to fall into that, you know, habit of mind where you're talking with somebody and you say, oh, God, it was so much better in those days and whatever.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of things that really were more fun. It was a less constricted industry. It was a less frightened industry. Mm-hmm. The publishing houses hadn't consolidated themselves into a handful of giant houses. There was no Amazon that was sort of driving the train. And in many ways, the literary culture in New York of the 1980s, which is sort of equidistant now from the, no, it isn't, I'm not good at math, but it's somewhere between the 1920s and the 2020s that we're in now. And in many ways, I think it was more like the literary life of the 1920s mm-hmm. than it is like the literary life of the present day, because the whole, you know, electronic revolution has devoured us in many ways.
Oh,
and
yes.
So it was a very social time, and I was ambitious, you're right, and I was, you know, determined to make the most of it. Mm-hmm. And then when I worked at Condé Nast, when I was, as you mentioned, the literary editor at GQ, Condé Nast was in its absolute fat and happy days when they wanted, you know, half of my job was to spend money. I was supposed to take writers and agents and editors to lunch. And I had plenty of time for my own writing, and I was meeting all of these people, you know, in the industry. And it was really a wonderful opportunity. But there was so much money in magazine publishing in mm-hmm. particular in those days that, I mean, I once got called in. I mean, I was kind of like the country mouse at the magazine because I had spent all these years as a college professor, and I had arrived here in my late 30s. And I got called in about 6 months after I started. And the managing editor said, I need to go over your expense account, your expense report, you know, for all these lunches and things. And the problem was it was too low. he went through it item by item. Where did you take? You took so-and-so here. You took so-and-so here. Whatever. And he didn't object to anything that I was doing, anybody I was having lunch with. But he wanted to know, are you sure you're taking people to places that are commensurate with the company image?
Wow.
And you know, I must have said something to him like, you mean wretched excess? And I, you know, and nobody could really disagree with that. So I caught the tail end of that.
Well, happy days.
Just before the internet. Yeah.
You happy days. Now, I often think about literary citizenship and what it means. And there's so much work in that, you know, doing the support work for literary culture, being in reading series, planning them, teaching, editing, advocating for the work of others. And you have certainly done that. You have spent a lot of time advocating for the work of others. And that shines through in these diaries.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think that's my sense of you know, my own good luck. And I know when I think of the favors that people did me early on in my career, you know, Mary McCarthy, who's a writer who's sort of faded in the public imagination. I mean, Mary's been dead for nearly 40 years, but she was a friend and mentor to me. And she blurbed my early books. And when she died, it was on the front page of the New York Times.
Yeah.
The first time that you get asked, that somebody else asks you to blurb their book, is one of those wonderful moments for a writer when you think, oh, mm-hmm. my God, you know, they want my name as an endorsement, you know, when you've been scrounging for blurbs in the past. But I think that all of those things are really important. You sit on prize juries, you, you know, sit on fellowship committees, and you're in the swim of things. And that keeps the machinery turning for everybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it does get harder, or it needs to be reimagined as the decades go on and the whole process of producing a book changes to some extent. One of the things that I was also struck by when I was reading these diaries from the 80s was, for all that it was a terrifying time, I also was aware that I had it so much easier than young writers have it today. I think that, you know, I mean, it was never easy, you know, to break in as a writer, to become a first novelist, to stay as a novelist. I do think another thing that is true today, it's harder to sustain a literary career than it was back then. Publishers would stick with writers longer. They didn't really expect them to make anybody, you know, a lot of money with first books. Now you have to kind of succeed more quickly, mm-hmm. or this ever faster moving machinery will leave you behind.
It's scary.
But it's still the enticement of becoming a writer is still so enormous for people. People still feel it very, very young, and they feel it very strong. And it's one of those things that if you get the bug, it's all you want to do. It's mm-hmm. all you're going to settle for.
Now, one of the things I love about your work is that you're just fearless about taking on the big subjects. Henry and Clara set around the Lincoln assassination. Mm-hmm. Dewey defeats Truman, Aurora 7, Watergate, and finally Landfall, which dives right into Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath. So talk a little bit about Landfall for us, for our New Orleans readers.
I'd been down to New Orleans a lot in the 90s, the early 2000s. I fell in love with the city. I wasn't in New Orleans until the first time, which is when, as we were talking before, I think I met you. Mm-hmm. I had just passed 40 at that point, but I began to go to New Orleans a lot. I had a peculiar kind of involvement with the aftermath of Katrina in that right after the hurricane, I was the deputy chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, where I was sort of the number two guy at the agency in this enormous office. And one of my jobs was dealing with emergency grants. They were typically small. They were about $30,000, and they didn't have to go through the regular review process, mm-hmm. which, you know, can take ages. It was sometimes just a single, sometimes handwritten. It would be some small historical society in New Orleans or somewhere along the Gulf Coast, whatever. We need money immediately for mold abatement because our collection's been damaged, whatever. So in a strange way, I wasn't back in New Orleans until, I guess, pretty deep into 2006. But the city was on my mind all the time. It really stuck with me.
We've been talking with Thomas Mallon, whose most recent book is The Very Heart of It, New York Diaries, 1983 to 1994. Landfall, Henry and Clara, so many other wonderful books. You can meet him at the 40th Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival, Saturday, March 28th at 4, when he appears in conversation with playwright Martin Sherman and NPR commentator Maureen Corrigan. Or at the Saints and Sinners Festival, Sunday, March 29th at 11:30 for a panel approaching 50 years of AIDS literature, and then at the Saints and Sinners Reading Sunday, May 29th at 2:30. Tom, thank you so much. This has been a pure pleasure.
Thank you. Same for me, and looking forward to seeing you again down in New Orleans.
Oh, absolutely. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. New Orleans writer and artist Romy Petit will lead a three-part series, Graphic Novel Boot Camp, at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The dates are 5:30 to 7:30, Wednesday, March 11th, Wednesday, March 18th, and Wednesday, March 25th. It's free of charge and open to the public, but intended for adults. The aim of this workshop is to write and complete an 8-page short story in the graphic novel format, ready to be illustrated. Coming up, the 5th Annual New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University gets underway March 12th through 15th. Among the more than 200 authors scheduled to appear are Stacey Abrams, Rick Atkinson, Jamie Attenberg, Charles Blow, David Brooks, Ken Burns, Anderson Cooper, Roxane Gay, Jeffrey Goldberg, Annette Gordon-Reed, Molly Jong-Fast, Katie Kitamura, Eric Larson, Nancy Lemon, Nicholas Lemon, Don Lemon, John Meacham, Governor Westmore, Sigrid Nunes, Elaine Pagels, Salman Rushdie, and Cleo Wade. Sunday is Family Day, an entire day devoted to children's books and reading activities. Check out the complete schedule at nola.bookfest.tulane.edu. Events are free, but registration is encouraged.
Here are some great picks for the weekend from New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University. On Saturday, March 14th at 1 in the Kendall Cram Room, Molly Jong-Fast and Susan Orlean discuss their memoirs with moderator Thomas Beller. Saturday, March 14th at 1 at the Fogelman Arena at the Devlin Fieldhouse, Anderson Cooper and Dax Shepard talk about processing grief. On Saturday, March 14th at 4 o'clock, Who We Are, Stories That Shape a Nation, with Stacey Abrams, Eddie Glaude Jr., and Viet Thanh Nguyen, moderated by Charles Blow. And then Sunday, for Family Day, you can see Margaret Orr talk about Scrim, My Tale Is Told to Margaret Orr. That's Sunday from 1:20 at the Fogelman Arena at the Devlin Fieldhouse. And then Sunday, March 15th at 1:30, Xavier Rush talks about the fitness alphabet. On Sunday, March 15th at 1:30, Xavier Rush reads from Fitness Alphabet, XR Elite Experience. You'll be reading that on the main stage of the Fogelman Arena for Family Day.
The 40th Annual Tennessee Williamson New Orleans Literary Festival is March 25th through 29th, primarily at the Hotel Monleon, but throughout the French Quarter. This year's special guests include Charles Baxter, Maureen Corrigan, Michael Cunningham, Thomas Keith, Martin Sherman, Justin Torres, Boyce Upholt, and Joshua Wheeler. The five-day event includes theatrical productions, walking tours, and a writing marathon. Tickets and info at TennesseeWilliams.net. The 23rd Annual Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival takes place March 27th through 29th, also at the Hotel Monleon. Featured speakers include Margot Dwahi, Robert Fiesler, Jewel Gomez, Daniel W.K. Lee, Thomas Mallon, Gene Redman, Martin Sherman, Justin Torres, and many others. Events include panel discussions, a reading series, craft sessions, and walking tours. Tickets and info at sasfest.org.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.